by calling.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the January 17th reading of The Environment, a collection of articles from the Sierra Club magazine, Mother Earth News, and the Nature Conservancy magazine. My name is John. I have a couple articles this afternoon from the Sierra Club magazine. Our first main article, Everything is Not Pura Vida in Costa Rica. The country's banana industry is heavily reliant on chemical pesticides that threaten the environment and public health. This article was written by Michael Fox. Our second main article, also from the Sierra magazine, How to Plug into the Benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act, Some Tips for Fighting Global Warming by Electrifying Your Life. Our first article, Everything is Not Pura Vida in Costa Rica. Here we go. The drive down Costa Rica's Highway 36, which traces the Caribbean coast toward the Panama border south of Sixaola, is lined with seemingly endless banana plantations. From the air, the farms stretch on for miles, a sea of manicured green, the trees tidy and lined in rows. From the road, the lush green fronds hang over one another and onto the worn two-lane highway, forming an impregnable wall of thick vegetation. The bananas themselves, however, are often hard to see. They are covered in blue plastic bags. This helps protect the precious fruit and also keeps them constantly fumigated to destroy pests. The blue bags are the most visible sign of the intense industrialization of banana production on Costa Rica's farms. Costa Rica is the world's third largest exporter of bananas. In 2021, banana exports reached $1.23 billion, and some 28,000 people work on banana farms across Costa Rica today. But banana plants are susceptible to a host of illnesses and blights. That's because banana plants don't reproduce by seed. They produce via rhizomes, which have several buds. In other words, banana trees are essentially clones, lacking genetic diversity, which makes them especially susceptible to pests and disease. The most common variety is the Cavendish banana. This is the banana plant that stretches for miles across Costa Rica's Caribbean lowlands and the fruit that most often you find in your supermarket aisles. The intensive use of pesticides on Costa Rican banana farms here is staggering. Toxic chemicals, including many pesticides banned elsewhere in the world, have poisoned people and ecosystems. They've caused birth defects, killed fish and wildlife, and they continue to be sprayed at massive levels, even if they are largely unnoticed by the 2.3 million foreign tourists that visit the country in 2022. Mentions of Costa Rican often conjure up images of cloud forests, pristine jungle, and gorgeous beaches. And it's true that the country prides itself on its ecotourism and nature reserves. But in contrast to its eco-groovy image and Pura Vida vibe, Costa Rica has one of the highest rates of pesticide use per capita of anywhere in the world. In the mornings, before the afternoon rains, crop dusters fly low over the fields. The buzz from the propellers wash over the countryside like a swarm of bees. On a warm, overcast afternoon in September, the head of the Banana Workers Union at Chiquita's Tayrona Plantation, Carlos Quiroz, walked me through the process of pesticide application on the farm, listing off an alphabet soup of chemicals applied to the land over the growth cycle. Before they plant the banana, they use several types of herbicides, be it Reglone, be it Gramazone, be it Biokill, be it a permanent herbicide that wipes the land clean for 6 months and nothing is born after it is applied, Quiroz said. When the little plants are growing, they start to apply the nematicides, three different types. Nematicides are a type of chemical pesticide used to kill parasitic nematodes or roundworms. Then there's the aerial fumigation to control the fungal disease Black Sigatoka, plus a whole host of other insecticides. Finally, there's the chemical fumigation bags that cover the fruit as it grows on the tree. Quiroz says a total of 8 or 9 different pesticides are used on each crop throughout the year. I do believe the banana is one of the agricultural products where the highest level of chemicals are applied, he said. Because from the moment it is planted to the moment it is producing, it is controlled by chemicals. According to a recent study on pesticides in Costa Rica, published in the scientific journal Environmental International, 79 different pesticide molecules are authorized in Costa Rica to be applied on banana plantations. Those pesticides are available in 818 different products. Among them are 43 fungicides, 12 herbicides for weed control, 6 insecticides sprayed on the plants, another 7 insecticides placed in the blue bags wrapped around the growing bananas, and 8 nematicides. Many of the products are banned in the European Union and the United States. The pesticide load is much higher, 10 times more than what we have in temperate regions, said Carsten A. Bruhl, a specialist on pesticides at Germany's University of Koblenz-Landau, who has studied pesticide use extensively in Costa Rica and participated in the Environmental International study. For example, on wine in Germany, we use 8 kilograms of pesticides, mainly fungicides per hectare, each year. And on banana plantations, it can be up to 60 or 70 kilos of product. So that's 10 times more. And the reason is because you apply every week in Costa Rica, he said. Banana workers at the Chiquita farm say the company routinely directs them to apply chemicals without labels or without explanation of the safety concerns. Union leaders say the company only encourages workers to use protective gear when there is some sort of audit or visit from supervisors or a regulatory agency. Sierra tried to reach out to Chiquita in both Costa Rica and the head office in Switzerland for this story. At the time of publication, Chiquita had not responded to our questions. Valdivieso Miller has worked for 33 years with the chemical bags on banana farms in this region of Costa Rica. He's stout, with thick, powerful hands from a lifetime laboring the fields and a shade of skin that tells of an indigenous heritage. Miller said he often gets toxic substance in his eyes when he's moving the banana leaves to bag the bananas after plants have been dusted from the plains in the morning. I cannot see far, he said. I feel like my eyes are blocked with smoke. I cannot recognize people from afar, and I know it's from working with the chemicals. They might say no, or that there's no way to prove it, but I know that it's because of the chemicals. Union leaders say more than 10% of the men who work with the banana bags have issues with their eyes, cataracts, or partial blindness, likely due to the chemicals. Farm workers elsewhere say their fingernails have fallen out from chemical exposure. The pesticides also impact the surrounding community. In Matina County, near the regional capital of Limon, half of elementary schools are less than 500 feet from banana fields. One 2014 study of 451 pregnant women living near banana plantations showed they all had highly elevated concentrations of the fungicide mancozeb, which is sprayed on the fields from above. Sterility and birth defects are not uncommon. Some local residents say crop fumigations have caused cancer. Between 2010 and 2020, 58 people were reported to have died from pesticide poisoning. It is really concerning, says Silvia Escriveria Sanez, a biologist and researcher at the National University Central American Institute for Studies on Toxic Substances, that pesticides are meant to control plagues on the plantation, but they are exercising their toxic effect off the plantations. We have identified pesticides across many layers of the environment, air, water, soil, and also in subterranean water. In 2022, Costa Rica's health ministry ordered residents of the town of Cipreses up the mountains toward the capital, San Jose, to stop consuming their drinking water after it was found to contain the fungicide chlorothalonil at levels up to 200 times higher than the safe limit. The product is banned in the EU, but until late last year, it was commonly used on farms across Costa Rica. Chlorothalonil was prohibited by presidential decree on November 30th, 2023, what, like 60 days ago. This came on the heels of another presidential decree in late 2022 that updated the Agricultural Pesticide and Fertilizer Code. In a written statement to Sierra, Costa Rica's Environment Ministry said that the update was decades in the making and that it will allow the country to register new, more efficient products that have already been approved by other member countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Costa Rica joined that organization in 2021. The Ministry of Environment guarantees that pesticides and other agricultural inputs that are registered in the country do not represent an unacceptable risk to the environment, and mitigation measures for associated risks are identified and promoted, the Environment Ministry wrote to Sierra. Risk mitigation measures must be included in product pamphlets so that users have clear instructions for their use, reducing impacts outside the areas of cultivation. Costa Rica also prohibits the use of harmful agrochemicals that are already prohibited in at least 80% of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Nevertheless, Escriveria Sainz says the pesticide use per hectare in Costa Rican farms is 400% what it was just 30 or 40 years ago, in part due to greater pest resistance to the products. The increase in spraying is taking a toll on the local ecosystem. According to water samples from rivers that have high concentrations of pesticides, we have seen toxic impacts such as mortalities. Organisms have had lower reproduction. We have seen growth defects and changes in the ecosystems near large cultivations, such as decreasing diversity, she said. The Jaguar Rescue Center is a private animal rehabilitation center located about a dozen miles from the banana farms in Sixeola. The center treats roughly 1,000 animals a year and specializes in helping animals return to the wild. But the staff there has two resident sloths that cannot leave, Taranga and Mufasa. They are incredibly adorable, but are about half the size that they should be. That's because they both have stunted growth and were born with birth defects, including a bowel deformity. They would not last on their own in the forest. The sloths were found in two different locations along the Caribbean coast, both in the middle of intensive banana-producing regions. The sloth sanctuary of Costa Rica has seen a similar trend, receiving 9 orphaned baby sloths showing deformities, including missing fingers and toes, malformed ears, misshapen limbs, and partial or full albinism. Carlos Gutierrez, a biologist and guide at the Jaguar Rescue Center, said he believes the pesticides are to blame. "It's really disturbing and nothing is being done about it," he said. "The owners of these companies sell Costa Rica as a green place, but they do not care about these things." The pesticides are not just coming from banana farms. Costa Rica has many cash crops, coffee, rice, or sugar. The next time you go to the supermarket and pick out a nice ripe pineapple, chances are it's from Costa Rica. 86% of pineapples sold in the United States come from Costa Rica, which is the top exporter of the fruit on the planet. Roughly 30,000 people are directly employed in the pineapple industry, and the level of pesticide use is just as intensive as on the banana farms. The widespread pesticide pollution in the small Central American country reveals a great contradiction with Costa Rica's green image. As numerous experts interviewed for this story underscored, the pesticide use does not negate the fact that the country has made huge strides towards environmental protection. Costa Rica has been a pioneer in conservation, and a quarter of the country is protected in national parks and reserves. Costa Rica is home to between 4 and 5% of the planet's biodiversity. 98% of Costa Rica's energy is renewable. Costa Ricans really embrace the idea of being an eco-country, Brule said. This is the one country that turned around forestation. They were deforested and they reforested. That is an exceptional thing. Many, many countries can learn from Costa Rica. But on the other hand, there is this pesticide issue. Researcher Escriveria Sainz explained that at the root of this contradiction is the importance the agricultural sector has traditionally played as a pillar of the country's economy. They have justified practices that have been inadequate in terms of conservation, but that favor agricultural production, she said. As a motor of employment, income, and the development of the country, they have pardoned agricultural practices that could be detrimental for the environment because they have weighed them against the economic contribution that those crops make for the country. Echeverria Sains said change is necessary and there are alternatives to the status quo. For example, growers could practice crop rotation, shade growing, and sustainable agricultural management systems. They could use organic fertilizer by leaving leaves and plant matter to decompose into the soil. And there are examples of sustainable banana farms, even in Costa Rica. In 2022, the United Nations warned Costa Rica it needed to cut back on its pesticide dependence, but there are many obstacles to doing so. When the producers are asked about who visits them most in their fields, it is clear that the sellers of agrochemical products visit them more than specialists from the Ministry of Agriculture, said Maria Arias Andreas, also a researcher at the Central American Institute for Studies on Toxic Substances. And the programs for promoting cultivation without pesticides, as well as organic certifications, remain limited and expensive for small and medium-sized producers. In other words, Costa Rica is likely to walk the tightrope of its environmental contradiction for many years to come. This afternoon's next article, also from the magazine of the Sierra Club, How to Plug Into the Benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act, Some Tips for Fighting Global Warming by Electrifying Your Life, written by Osha Gray Davidson. When the Inflation Reduction Act became law in 2021, climate change experts agreed that it would be a game changer for the clean energy industry. It is that, and it is also a giant step for the rest of us. That's because no matter what your budget is, or whether you own a house or rent an apartment, you qualify for some of the $370 billion contained in the IRA, the largest climate reduction change program in United States history. Wherever you are in your journey toward decarbonization, the Inflation Reduction Act has something to help you make that next appliance cheaper to run, healthier to use, and emit less carbon dioxide, Noah Goldman says. Goldman's official title is Federal Policy Associate at the nonprofit Rewiring America, but Inflation Reduction Act Guru is probably a more accurate title for Goldman. One of the great things about the IRA is that it tackles every piece of the electrification puzzle, Goldman says, from utilities to you and to me. With so many puzzle pieces, however, knowing the best way to take advantage of the Inflation Reduction Act can be a bit bewildering. That's where Rewiring America comes in. Rewiring America, which describes itself as the leading electrification nonprofit working to electrify our homes, businesses, and communities, has several online tools for helping people get their fair share of financial assistance from the Inflation Reduction Act. A good place to start is at Rewiring America's Savings Calculator, Goldman explains. You can go to our website, plug in some basic information about your household, and then see what tax credits and rebates you qualify for based on your income, household size, and location. Easy peasy, right? If you're planning on getting major upgrades or doing a complete home energy retrofit, you'll probably want to begin by getting an energy audit. An energy audit is a great place to start, Goldman says. You can hire an auditor who will look at your house with an eye toward choosing the electrification measures that can get you the biggest bang for your buck. If you're considering upgrading from a dirty, gas-fired furnace, for example, an energy audit might reveal that you'd be better off installing insulation first before springing for the more expensive heat pump. If you go this route, you'll be happy to know that the Inflation Reduction Act provides a $150 tax credit for an energy audit. It is likely that most Americans will make big appliance changes only as needed, like when a water heater or stove or furnace is about to give out. The IRA has provisions for those just-in-time replacements, and Rewiring America's website is there to walk you through the process. Click through its links to find the appliance you need to replace, and you'll find plenty of suggestions on what to buy and how to get IRA funding to help pay for it. Keep in mind that, for the most part, the IRA's consumer programs were not designed to make clean, energy-efficient appliances for free. The programs were designed to make the cost of purchasing new energy-efficient appliances on par with buying inefficient and polluting older technologies. The amount households receive is pegged to income, with more generous incentives available to households that need it the most, including fully covering the cost of some items for households earning less than 80% of the area median income. Of course, even with the help of tax credits and rebates, heat pump water heaters and induction cook stoves are major expenses. Most Americans probably cannot afford to buy these items outright, so they'll need to get a loan. While interest rates have come down a little in recent months, they're still relatively high. That's why the IRA includes $14 billion to buy down the cost of financing for low to moderate income households. Goldman points out, it's not just the appliances that need to be affordable, but also the cost of financing. Some people have expressed frustration that not all the benefits of the IRA have been rolled out yet. But Lori Bird, director of the World Resource Institute's U.S. Energy Program, told Sierra, the time frame is not necessarily a problem. What's important with a program this big and complex, she says, is that designers get it right. It's going to take a little bit of time, but we're going to get there, she says, and reminds people that the tax credits and rebates from the IRA will be available for a full decade. That will help the majority of American households to replace old appliances with clean tech, new ones as needed. The IRA's smart structure also allows consumers time to do the research necessary to buy electric vehicles, the single largest ticket item for most families. There's a lot of confusion in the marketplace, Bird says, because the IRA benefits for EVs are complicated. Even auto dealers are still learning which makes and models qualify for assistance, she says. The confusion stems from the formula used to set IRA funding, which includes the percentage of the vehicle manufactured in the United States and whether the minerals used in fabricating EV batteries were domestically sourced. The good news is that, as of January 1, buyers of qualifying EVs can get their $7,500 tax credit at the time of purchase, cash on the hood, that will sweeten the deal for many buyers. Fortunately, Bird says, sources like Consumer Reports have been doing a good job of tracking information on EVs and the IRA. While the IRA does contain funding for individuals to install home systems for charging EVs, the nation will still need an estimated 1 million public chargers to electrify our current fossil fuel-based transportation sector, the largest contributor of greenhouse gases. A related 2021 federal program provides funding for some 500,000 EV charging stations throughout the country. Exactly where those chargers are located will determine who has access to them, and that concerns Avery Connor. Having the funding available was an important step in the right direction, says Connor, who directs the Center for Environmental and Climate Justice at the NAACP. Now there needs to be a strengthening of accountability to make sure that communities that should be benefiting actually are. Sometimes in the course of reporting a story, you become part of it. That's what happened to me after talking with Goldman. Thinking about the aging and noisy heat pump on my roof, I decided to take his advice and scheduled a home energy audit. It turned out to be the right decision. The audit revealed deficiencies in both our heat pump and the connected ductwork. We upgraded to a new variable speed heat pump with a SEER rating of 19 and corrected the problems with our ductwork. I qualify for a $2,000 tax credit on the heat pump via the IRA and a $1,450 rebate from my utility. The rebate is unrelated to the IRA, but I wouldn't have known it existed if the IRA had not sweetened the deal enough to upgrade. Admittedly, the project still was not cheap, but I see it as an investment in my house, a way to lower electric bills, and one small personal step toward a clean energy future. And it's all thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act. With 2 minutes remaining, let's take a quick look at what happened on January 17th in history. In 1773, Captain James Cook became the first to cross the Antarctic Circle. In 1873, Modoc warriors defeats the United States Army in the First Battle of the Stronghold, a part of the Modoc War. On January 17th in 1920, the first day of prohibition of alcohol comes into effect in the United States as a result of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution. In 1946, the United Nations Security Council holds its very first meeting at Westminster Central Hall in Westminster, England. And check this out. On January 17th in 1984, the Supreme Court of the United States rules 5-4 that private use of home VCRs to tape TV programs for later viewing does not violate federal copyright laws. Benjamin Franklin was born on January 17th in 1706, and Muhammad Ali was also born on January 17th in 1942, along with Al Capone in 1899. And with that, we'll conclude today's reading. Thanks so much for joining us for the January 17th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.